I'm Marie Carty and I'm going to die. And so are you. And so is everybody you know. In these shorter episodes, La Petite Mort, The Little Death, I'll be speaking to people about the culture of death and dying. The art we make, the words we write, the absurd and beautiful ways we all process the act of letting go. As we know, there's no wrong way to navigate grief. We need to move towards it to move through it. Sister Zai Zander is an Afrofuturist, poet and womanist. She was born in Harare, Zimbabwe, and raised in a large extended family, descending from the Kurunga language group and now living as a Black African settler on Kulin Nation land. I've known Zai from around the literary circles in Melbourne, and whenever I have the chance to see her speak or perform or just be anywhere near her incredible warmth and energy, I jump at it. Her heart is so expansive, and she always has something amazing to share about healing or creative practice, vulnerability, and finding joy. Amongst many career highlights, Zai is a 2019 recipient of the NILMA Sydney Travel Fund and a recipient of the Melbourne Strategic Scholarship for a PhD in Afrofuturism at the Uni of Melbourne. One of her favourite Afrofuturistic philosophies is the ancient belief that no one and nothing dies, we just change form and sometimes reincarnate. Beauty, I'm so happy to be speaking to you, as I always am in the world.
I've been so excited for this conversation. You've got no idea. Like, I'm ready.
I love that when I wrote to you and said, oh, would you like to come on this podcast and talk about death, you instantly responded with the most amazing collection of quote-unquote top-line thoughts about death and dying, but through the lens of African philosophy and culture. And I just knew you would be the perfect person to speak to about this. What comes up when you're asked to interrogate themes of death and dying?
Well, I think my first experiences of death and dying and how I was coached as a very young person who was moving through the HIV/AIDS pandemic and its impact in Southern Africa, which was huge, you know? And so I'm like 12, 13, I'm just starting to date. I'm getting curious about sex. People are dying. Like, what's going on? I know the people who are dying. And so my aunt's just basically taking me through and teaching me how to grieve. And that there's always going to be moments for joy, for laughter. You don't always have to be sad all the time. And going to funerals and watching like how our people have buried each other for such a long time with so much joy, but also moments and times for like just really deep grief, but collectively, like holding vigil all night, singing together, you know, drumming, talking, eating together. And then at the end of it all, like taking a bath. This is when my grandmother passed away. We all went down to the river, took a bath, throw away those clothes, and you go on to life, you know?
How did that, I mean, that's so fascinating when you were coming of age, for want of a better term, in terms of sex and sexuality. That's such a kind of formative experience to tie sex and death together at a young age. Has that continued affecting you onwards into adulthood?
I think for a lot of us who were sort of, you know, navigating the pandemic, the HIV/AIDS pandemic, yeah, for sure. You know, the way that it was advertised to us, it definitely had a huge impact on how we understood sex and sexuality. You know, and it's not the best, it wasn't the best form of advertising. Like, I got to law school and I was like, well, if I was a public health official with the UN, how would I change the HIV/AIDS messaging so that we can celebrate sexuality, you know, and also understand just how people do relationships in Southern Africa, you know, because it's very queer. It's just naturally very queer. It's very polygamous. It's very polyamorous. I mean, those are the terms that we would use here, you know, and so the whole monogamy approach to being safe, it just didn't work.
There's definitely, I mean, just speaking from a Western culture perspective in terms of HIV and AIDS having a real sense of shame attached to it when I was a kid, and it was secret and no one wanted to, and it's
really beautiful now to see HIV activists or, you know, people living in this in a really positive, joyous sense, which is part of their identity in a really beautiful way.
Yeah, I mean, and that's something that I think folks probably back home are still working on because that messaging was so heavy and intense, you know. But I think for us, really, the most massive impact is how it changed our grieving culture, because we had so many funerals in a weekend because our families are huge. We're huge, extended, connected people, you know. So you could a neighborhood could easily have 10 funerals in one weekend. And then we had to change our way of grieving because a funeral can last 2 weeks. So it had to go down to a day.
I thought it was really fascinating when you told me that in African philosophies and culture and spirituality, death is not the opposite of life. Life is eternal. Like in physics, energy can neither be created or destroyed. Now, you did talk about we had to pivot. We were burying so many people. We had to, but was that element of life being eternal, that was already pre-existing. That wasn't just the HIV AIDS pandemic that affected that, right?
That's pre-existing. And that's such a good point, because that's one of the ways that I came to then understand death and what was happening. Because my mom would point out to me, she'd say, oh, you see, somebody just passed away, but someone just had a baby. And so that's sort of the, I was like, oh, yeah, that's so interesting. Like every time a baby was born, we would go, oh, I wonder who's ready to pass on. But then we also have like these, when I was very young, so this is like way before HIV AIDS came into the picture. We went to my rural homeland in Mashingo and we carried out a ritual for my grandfather, which is called Kuruagula, which is to beat the ground or to beat the grave. And that is a ritual that is performed so that a person's energy and spirit can then enter into the ancestral realm and they can then start to look after the entire family as a revered ancestor. And so being very young and having witnessed that and all the ritual and ceremony, so people will continue to come back even after you've buried somebody. You know, a year later you come back, 2 years later you come back, 3 years later, you come back. So everybody's collectively held through that process over a number of years. And there's a number of rituals that are done. And that person is constantly in your thoughts and you're constantly thinking about them as well.
I know, I mean, I've known and loved you and your work for many years now. I know you're such an advocate for healing and connection and community. And I see ritual and symbolism in the work you do as well, in your spoken word, in your writing. What are the ways that those rituals and that symbolism assist us in the process of grieving and of letting go?
Well, I mean, that's the everyday, like life, every single day you are born at dawn. When the sun rises, you are born. When the sun sets and you go to sleep, well, you know, we don't go to sleep when the sun sets, but traditionally we would have, right? That's when you die and you go into the underworld, but that's you going into another realm of existence, another dreamscape. Some people would actually say that's when you're truly awake, is when you're dreaming, you know. So you can use that to navigate life. You know, you might have a challenging day. You might have an ego death that day. You may have to navigate a challenging relationship situation, some drama, whatever it is that's happening in your life. But then at the end of the day, you can think back on what's happened. You can think back on how possibly you might have responded differently. And then the next day, when the sun rises, you're born anew and you can take that wisdom into the new day, so into the new life. And so that's the idea that, life is eternal. Like we are here to grow. We are here to expand in our awareness. We're here to evolve, you know. And I suppose at the center of that is this whole concept of relationship being the most important thing about life. You know, if you think about that, if you're living in these huge extended family systems, it is all about relationship. And everything we do is about maintaining harmony with our living relatives, maintaining harmony with our ancestors, maintaining harmony with the earth. And so understanding that, you know, like your energy, because we have totems as well. So when you... Okay, I think the easiest way to talk about this without people going, ooh, okay, Black Panther. So you know that scene where they take the purple heart-shaped herb And then they go into the ancestral realm and they speak to a particular ancestor who is speaking to the challenges that they have to face and conquer in that moment.
Mm.
So that's kind of like the idea is that you're, but these ancestors are like living in a tree and they're actually in panther form. And then when they descend the tree and they come onto the ground and they take on the human form. So every person has a totem. And so when you pass away, your energy, your spirit goes and resides in that particular group of animals, if you want to call them that. You know, I mean, Western philosophy, you know, cuts us off from nature and says those are animals and those are human beings and that's a tree and we're all separate, but we're actually all one. So, yeah, it's just like all energy. We come out of all energy. And we've heard this before, like if you follow physics and stuff, like, but that's African philosophy, is that we are just like a tiny little manifestation of the larger energy that is out there. And so when we shed this human form that we're in and this current experience that we're having, we just go back into that existence and that larger form. So I guess to bring it back to like performance and also how to, I guess, maybe not so much performance, but what's been on my mind lately is I call them iterations. So when I curate shows or curate, like I have a platform, the Pan-African Poets Cafe, and it's gone through so many different stages. And I always go through a grieving stage at some point because I'm like, oh, that doesn't work that well anymore. The environment has changed. People don't really want that anymore. Do I can the whole thing or do I keep going? I'm like, if something always says to me, no, you have to keep going with it, because this is as much about you learning something about yourself, learning something about your culture, learning something about African cultures in general, not just traditional, but like in the contemporary form too. So it's this constant sort of like regeneration and this constant, what did I learn from the last? But it's not about scaling. It's not about becoming bigger. It's about responding to the environment and being in harmonious relationship with what's going on in the environment. And sometimes coming in and challenging an environment to maybe shift things in a different way. And then having the courage to do that. So having the courage to live in that purpose for 2 years, 3 years, however long that iteration will last, however long it will be received by people in that way. So it's a constant death and dying. It's like seasons of life. There is a spring, there is a summer, there is an autumn, there's a fall. And so recognizing when to let go and how to transition through those moments without trying to hold on to the summer and being okay with it being in winter where nobody can see anything happening, but like, you know, like the roots of a tree, you're like deepening into the earth, you're nourishing the roots, you're nourishing the tree so that when the shoots come in the next season, it's that the tree is well nourished and it's like really rooted in something tangible and real.
That's the way you're discussing it, and it's so true, is that there's actually thousands and thousands of tiny deaths and griefs per day that we let go of ideas. I love that when you said ego, the ego death we had before, like I'm sure I have several of them a day, but to let go of them and bury them, whether it be an expectation of what we were going to do that day or something that didn't work out or something, there's just, we tend to pin grief as this one big immovable object that happens specifically tied to when someone or something we love dies. But actually, death is kind of quite specifically around us all the time, and we have to be in that constant state of regeneration and renewal. I also keep thinking about there's so many things that you're mentioning that are almost through work that I've done in going to therapy is radical acceptance. And when you talked about being born in the morning and the death in the evening, I mean, that's beginner's mind, isn't it? Which is that therapeutic technique of trying to see something as if you're always doing it for the first time, never coming with that expectation, always. Do you think it's possible to reframe grief and loss in that way?
Yeah, I do think so. I think we live in a paradigm, like a dominant paradigm, where the focus is always on longevity and so a linear trajectories. Everything is on a line and everything is increasing. So the longer you're doing something, the bigger and the more spectacular it always has to be. It's a machine culture. That's how a machine, because a machine can just keep producing at the same level of output without ever taking a break, without ever taking a rest, always repeating the same motion over and over and over again. But as human beings, we can't do that physically. Like, it's actually beyond us. And it's not how we should function. And emotionally, it's impossible. It's impossible. So I think when we change our perspective to more of a cyclical one that follows the nature of seasons, you know, and I don't want to speak in terms of four seasons because, you know, I'm on Bunurong country, so I know that there's six here. But just to be very, if you even start taking notice of one tree or one plant that constantly comes up in your garden and you start noticing just, you know, like the cycles of life that it goes through in 1 year and the different life forms that are attracted to it as well. Even in the process of loss, something else is being drawn to that life form. So loss can actually be a shedding to allow for composting, you know. And so, for instance, in Zimbabwe, and I think there are other African cultures where they say this too, sometimes a child is born and people go, oh, that is Uncle so-and-so, because they speak just like Uncle so-and-so. You know, like, they act just like Uncle so-and-so. So people just think, oh, that's Uncle so-and-so come back in this form. You know, and so there is something that energy, that spirit wants to complete, but in a new cycle, surrounded by a new group of people. So I think moving from the linear, always increasing, endless increase model, which is, you know, something that we're all trained into thinking and how we're trained to believe that you're always going to have more. It's not true. There are times of plenty and there are times of famine. That's more true. And our relationships to ourselves and to each other don't have to shift during famine. It's not a scary time. In fact, it's a time when we need each other more.
I know that so much through your work and just in conversations you and I have had, how we understand that to speak about death and dying is in the same breath talking about survival and joy, that they're all linked together. I mean, that really speaks to the premise of what you're saying in terms of composting and renewal and growth, and all these words are linked to hope and optimism and mornings and brightness, but they can't happen without death and grief and letting go.
And I think also, you know, like when we speak of joy, people expect it to be like this, experience of like pure exhilaration and ecstasy or something. It's joy can come out of a lot of pain. You know, sometimes that's where we feel the most joy in a really weird way, because we are forced to find something to hold on to get through. And so we're forced to think, well, where is the silver lining here? Even though you're not, you know, I mean, there's a tendency to bypass the tough stuff. I wouldn't bypass the tough stuff, because that's where the composting happens. That's where the real regeneration and the growth and the expansion, and everybody can benefit from that learning. That's where that happens. But I mean, in this particular period in time on Earth, where there is so much death and we're all feeling that grief in a really deep way, and I think we're tapping into not just like our own grief, but ancestral grief as well. You know, so that's something that's quite new to me. I'm reaching out to people who know more about that, know more about how to move through grief, because people haven't had time or haven't had ritual and ceremony to grieve and to let go. You know, the big things, the big transformations that have happened in society that have moved all of us, regardless of where we're from, you know, we're seeing that mirrored, and it's tapping into maybe what our great grandparent went through, or you know, someone out there in our lineage went through that, and it's in our body too, because all of our ancestors are within us, you know. And so it's a really tough time. And to be able to then tap into, and some people resist it so much because it feels so wrong to take a break, to giggle, to laugh, you know, to do something that brings you just a sense of release and joy. But you have to. I think that's one of the first rules that I learned about grieving. And I will say it's a rule of grieving. My aunt came into my room. It was after my grandmother had passed away, and I'd been sobbing here, like, nonstop. And she said to me, it's okay to stop crying sometimes, you know? Make sure you eat something. Make sure you have some water. Make sure you go for a walk. Go into the sun. Catch up with your friends. Like, it's actually okay to take a break from feeling so intensely. And when you do that, then you can come back to it, because you do have to process the emotion. And that is part of the processing, is the feeling into it. But we feel guilty for stopping. You know, we don't know how to stop. We don't know how to tap into joy without, and to into delight without feeling guilty. You know, we talk about guilty pleasures, and then that seeps into how we grieve.
It's not just with the guilt that we feel. We feel like I'm disrespecting the memory of that dead person. If I'm watching something silly on television and laughing and not weeping over them, then I'm somehow disrespecting them. But that also is in tandem with people thinking, I cannot look away from what is happening globally because it's my responsibility as an ally to watch all the time. It's my responsibility to bear witness to the pain and suffering. And that is important. All of those things are important, but how does one find that balance in those spaces?
And I think that's the important thing, is how do you find your balance? And maybe one way of phrasing that is also, how do you hold on to your humanity? How do we all hold on to our humanity? So how do we not block, you know, I don't want to see it, I don't want to know about it, go into deep denial? Or how do we get so caught up in it that we end up just, you know, traumatizing ourselves vicariously and not really taking care of ourselves, so we can be present and focused and ready to take action when the time comes, you know?
It's traumatizing, and it's re-traumatizing ourselves as well. And as we know, I mean, I know from personal experiences that traumatized people don't always do their best work if they're not, you know, if they're still in a healing phase. It's when you act out, it's when you can hurt people, it's, you know, so it's an essential part of being in a community to look after yourself in order to be a better member of that community, right?
And I think this is it's such an interesting tension that exists here, because of how the society is kept, is sort of like set up in a very individualistic way, and people are ashamed of asking for help. Of saying, I need support right now. And also, because we work so hard and we work such long hours and we live so far away from each other, it's hard for us to have like that village where it's easy to just, you know, stop by and, hey, here's some soup. Hey, let's watch some TV. Hey, did you go for a walk today? I'm going to go for a walk. Let's go. You know, we don't have that self-care, collective care easily, readily, you know, kind of quote unquote packaged for us. We actually have to actively, proactively create it. And it's hard to do because it requires a time that the systems that we live within have to take away in order to create profit.
It's also because we diminish ourselves, because we go, I don't want to ask for help because I am a mere, when all this is happening, no one cares about me and I just got broken up with. Who cares about that when there's a global crisis? It's about understanding that those needs are integral to, as you said, that you would use the word humanity before, that all of us have to be safe in whatever realm that is in order to exist in a community.
Yeah. And that our lives don't stop happening because we're in a crisis, you know? And it's true. I mean, I was actually thinking about it. I was like, I think my favorite way to distract myself is to fall in love. It's the best distraction, right?
Yeah, I think I fall in love about 18 times a day. So,
It's the best, like, oh my God, the world is falling apart. And then there's this person and they're so lovely. It's the best distraction, right? And it's maybe it's one that's a little more allowed. Like, we don't have to feel so guilty about that pleasure. But that's the vibe.
You don't have to feel guilty on it. Maybe I don't think I can act out on every single one of the 18 people I fall in love with every day. Firstly, my calendar would be chaotic and I'm not sure it would be completely moral. But I do want to talk to you about something that you brought up, which when we first spoke about this, about traditional Zimbabwean funerals. And what I loved when you told me about this is that you said they're often full of comedy, yeah, which is not a word that you would associate with funerals generally.
So I have to be very specific. So I am Shona, on my mom's side, on my dad's side, rather. So what we do is there's vigil. So when we receive the body from the funeral home and we usually drive them back to the village, overnight there's a vigil. And in the morning, like, certain people are tasked with certain roles. Some people are feeding the community. Other people are actually digging the grave. So it's a very hands-on affair, very hands-on. And so you really get to see people moving through their grief throughout that. But when you get to the graveside, what happens, and that's sort of like, if you want to put it into performance terms, that's like the peak of the performance. You're at the grave now, right? And so emotions are extremely heightened because you're about to commit a body to the ground, you know? And that's a very hard thing. It's a very, very hard thing to do because that's actually, because you know, you spent all night with the physical form, you know, and now you have to release. Mm. And so usually the sisters and the wives-in-laws will put on the clothes of the person who's deceased and they'll have like they'll perform as if they are that person who's passed away. Little funny things that that person used to do all the time, little funny things that they used to say, just to kind of remind us of that, you know, their energy is still with us in our memories of them, that they're living on. So even as we're burying somebody, we still are, their memory is still very much alive in our mind. So that's a really, really important part. And it's a beautiful part because people literally fall apart laughing.
It sounds like a roast. It's a little bit like a roast.
It's a bit of a roast, like literally. You can't not laugh. You can't not laugh, you know. So even like if it's, you know, if a mother's lost a child, I mean, that would be the worst. Like if a parent loses their child, you know, and they're in absolute grief. Like for that moment, they just like in hysterics, in absolute hysterics, just remembering their person. But we do it right there at the grave.
That's amazing. Yeah. And so and so important. I was thinking I lost a young friend a couple of years ago and her parents, and it was during COVID, so of course, and she was in America. So, but they went through her clothes and they sent a piece of her clothing to everyone who had loved her. And I'm sure that would have been very difficult for them to let go of. As you know, we kind of tend to sometimes we hoard the belongings of that person, just or we feel guilty giving them. You know, some people clear things out, go straight to the op shop, some people hold them. But I just got one of Melissa's T-shirts. Oh. And it was just, I thought, what a lovely thing for them to do. So we all got to hold kind of a piece of her in that in the clothing as well.
That's beautiful. We do that too, but traditionally it was done a year after the person had passed away and then we would come back because their energy is still in the clothes that they wore. I have like scarves from my grandmother. I have a jumper. I've got a blanket. And so I could sometimes if I really miss her energy and her presence, I just turn back to those. It's like, you know, it's like my blankie, like literally.
Do you wear them or do you just, because sometimes people, they think, you know, I don't want to wear them in case the smell goes or the, you know, the smell of that person. I just want to keep it in a bag or like, do you wear them or just hold them?
I've worn them because it's like, you know, you just, yeah, I use them. I wear them. Yeah. Personally, other people may not want to, you know. I think it's up to you to choose what you want to do, how you want to flow with your grief.
And it's, I mean, there's no wrong way to grieve and it's not linear, as we know. And as you said before about all the ancestors being a part of us, you know, you being in the T-shirt is imbuing the T-shirt or the scarf with your own sense of self as well.
True. We change each other. I think that's one thing that I with my grandmother. My maternal grandmother passed away because she was such a huge mother figure for me in my life. And everyone would kind of joke that I was her youngest child. I just came into the world absolutely adoring her. So when she passed away, I just came to a place of thinking she lives on in me because of all the things that she taught me, all the things that she showed me, values or the way that she moved through the world. And sometimes those articles of clothing are very characteristic. The ones that I chose, at least, they're very characteristic of who she was as a person. And they're things that I do. And I know I picked them up from her, you know, and in wearing them or using them in a particular way, I feel like I deepened into an understanding of her, but also myself. Mm. Yeah. And so that's also how the person lives on, their energy. You change people. You change every single person you come into contact with. Like, there's no way you can die. Like, you live on. You live on in ways that you don't even know.
You shared some really beautiful kind of rituals. Is it the beating the ground ritual and things like that? I mean, there are rituals and symbolism connected to grief that go so far beyond, like so historically, culturally beyond. What does it look like to bring new rituals into that space? You're someone that is such an advocate for that. Are there new rituals that you've embodied in your practice, both living and grieving?
That's a really great question because I've been thinking about that a lot because I keep thinking about what I'm going to do for my funeral. Is that weird?
No. That's what I love talking to people about.
I'm like, there's no way I'm going to have like a full-on traditionals. But I mean, I could request it, but I really need to like plan this production before I pass away. There may not be drumming because we may not have the people who know how to do that here, but there'll probably be a sound system. There has to be a week-long party. I don't care what you're doing. I have to find a way to make that happen at some point. Everybody can drop in over the week. There's got to be great food, you know. And I think, preparing for that really basically means for me becoming very, very intentional about building strong relationships and intergenerational relationships as well within a society that maybe doesn't, like, I mean, obviously Aboriginal folks do have like that very tight family kinship model, but I'm coming in with the, kind of like the settler vibe. So it's very individualistic. It's very like, go, get for yourself, you know? So I'm really making chosen family with people and being very intentional with them about how we build community and what being family means and how showing up for one another looks like. And well, you know, those are very important things. Like that's the preparation that goes into, it's like living your life and living your life fully with people who you love and you can trust with that sort of stuff as well, you know? Because I think the funeral is more for the people who are left behind than it is for you as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as we know, I mean, I think it's really important to talk about death. Every now and then there's these like a spate of articles and there's always these occasional articles with like, we spoke to three palliative care doctors about what people wished at the end of their lives, what they wish they'd done differently, what they'd wish they'd done. And I always read them and so consistently people say, I wish I spent more time fostering family and friend connections. I was so driven on achieving or money or whatever it was. Really at the heart of it, our chosen family, our friends, our community, that is the meaning of our time on earth, right?
I believe it is. I mean, that's an understanding that I'm coming to more deeply, even though I grew up in that. Growing up in it and then leaving and having the option to go in another direction has taught me the value of relationship. And also show me that, you know, the energy that our grandparents put into maintaining connection, so it fed into subsequent generations, that's the level of, like, stewardship that we've been called into, so we have to carry that energy forward. And getting very serious about that, you know, going, well, how do we do this when so many Zimbabweans are in the diaspora? I've got, like, 40 first cousins, and we are all over the world.
Mm.
So how do we show up for each other? And then how do we teach our children to do that when we're not connecting like how we used to back home, where people would just drop in, stay for as long as they wanted. You wouldn't ask a question, like, whatever. That wasn't a question. Just, this is your home too. You know where I am. Like, that's...
How do you do that? How do you?
I think those are the new rituals. Like, we're working it out, you know? I mean, my utter joy at the moment is being an aunt. And, like, just these human beings who are just, like, they're the best. Like, they're the best little friends, really. You know, and just keeping them in mind and trying to figure out how to be in relationship with them and to be their friend and just to be there, you know? Like, these devices that we have can be quite useful. But then again, it's like, how much do you want young people to be exposed to screens? Well, there's all this to be navigated. But I think spending time, like just taking a weekend and flying interstate and being with my cousin and his family, or taking a weekend and going to Warburton and being with my chosen family, and, you know, taking 4 hours just to be with my nephew there. You know, he's like 3 and like... he loves adults. He doesn't really like children. So cute. So like, we'll sit and watch ABC, and like draw ABC, sing ABC, 1, 2, 3, you know, and just like allowing yourself to just like drop into that world, like his world, and just being a part of his world and seeing how he chooses to integrate you into that. And also just the joy of thinking, oh, you get to actually watch an entire human being grow and change and go through the motions, and they know that you are that person, that you're there, that you are there. So it's not as consistent as being in a village, but it is about making sure that you prioritize it. And of course, in the system that we live in, like, how do you measure abundance, you know? So it's shifting away from maybe like having oodles of cash and achievement to having lots of thick, deep, beautiful relationship and memories with folks, you know, and really rooting into that. And I think with that also comes like the collective care and the community care just becomes sort of like a resource sharing, you know, because I'm there as auntie, like I'm doing some serious caregiving work, you know, but they also feed into me. They're like, okay, here you go. We bought you groceries for 3 weeks. Like, oh, gee, that's so sweet. Thanks. You know what I mean? Like, so it just works. You just create your own little village in that way. I'm like, oh, you don't have to, but that's really sweet. They're like, yeah, gotta make everything balance out.
And that's, I mean, that's, I knowing you as I do, that's your heart reflected back, really, as well. I know that community, your chosen family, your family are so lucky to have you as such an integral, essential part of it.
Thank you.
I always love watching you move through the world and your output and what you take and give and how you teach and how you articulate your heart. And I love being near you and around you. And thank you so much for sharing all that you do with everyone all the time.
Marie, that is, I have no words now. I'm just like flooded with like good feeling. Thank you.
That's good.
Thank you. Thank you for seeing me. And I, you know, I just want to say it's not hard. It's not easy. It's bumpy, you know, and, you know, sometimes we expect it to always be super, super easy, but I think there can actually be a lot of grief in trying to be in relationship, you know, but staying in relationship as well until you come through that as it transitions and the relationships transition into a new way of being. And it's really, really tough at the moment. Like with some of my relationships, I'm just like, we stick it out.
They're the little deaths.
Those are the little deaths.
They're the little deaths within the relationship.
Exactly. And then I have to evolve and they have to evolve. And then what is the relationship now? Mm. So now we have to figure this out again.
It just doesn't stop. The work doesn't stop.
It's a lot.
When do I get my certificate saying I won at life? I don't understand. Fuck.
I feel you.
Beauty, thank you so fucking much.
Thank you.
For giving me your time and energy and just stories and care. And that means that hopefully we can give this to others who will take something from it as well, which is really the work, huh?
That's beautiful. This is such a beautiful project. Thanks for inviting me in.
Oh, I can't even with Zai. I love her so much. I always want to acknowledge how great it is being alive at the same time as so many of the people I talk to on this podcast. But I never want to take for granted that I get to bask in Zai's orbit on a semi-regular basis. I feel really privileged. I'll put all of Zai's details in the show notes. But if you do want to support her work in a tangible way, please follow Pan-African Poets Cafe on Instagram. Their handle is PAPOETS. In Zai's beautiful words, something delicious is slowly and intentionally brewing at the home of the Afro-literati. Having conversations about grief can really stir up some unexpected feelings. So if anything's arisen for you today as a result of something you've heard, please look after yourself. I fully acknowledge it's a privilege to talk about mortality in this way, and there are so many specific resources available as part of the show notes, so look them up. Check in on how you're feeling internally, call a friend, take a walk, pat a dog, just trust yourself. It really would mean a lot if you'd consider supporting the show in whatever way you can. You do you, babe. You can subscribe to Marieke Hardy Is Going to Die on Patreon. And signing up means you'll have a monthly newsletter, writing updates, Q&A. There's a whole community on there of people that I just adore. So please join. This wild and weird podcast is made by me, Marieke Josephine Hardy, and a team of fully golden hearts. Sammy Peterson, Darren Scarce, Camilla McEwen, Eamon Leggett, and Lauren Egan. Our beautiful podcast theme music is by my dear friend, Lord Fascinator. And I'd like to give special thanks to James Milsom and Amelia Chapelot.